thoughts and ideas and try to generate our entire mind in the aspect of refuge in the three jewels and the bodhicitta, the determination to engage in this action of discussing Dharma tonight in order to be able to train our mind in the path to full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Now, this is our third talk in the series of discussing the topic of the cultivation of bodhicitta, what we call the mind of conventional bodhicitta, the attitude, the supreme attitude, wishing to achieve our full potential of Buddhahood for the benefit of all others. We began discussing this topic in forms of the 7 points of mind training. Mind training, training the mind in universal responsibility, great compassion. The first of those was to meditate and gain experience with the graduated path teachings on the first and second levels, or the first and second scopes, recognizing what we have as a being born as a human in this time, with the great fortune to have met the Dharma from a lineage of teachers who have the unbroken lineage back to Shakyamuni Buddha, and we have all the necessary personal and circumstantial conditions to be able to practice Dharma. And how unique, how rare such a rebirth is when we look at the whole spectrum of possible rebirths, because of the dominance of the self-centered ignorance or the self-grasping ignorance. Most sentient beings are reborn in what we call the three lower realms, as an animal, hungry ghost, or a hell being, because ignorance, anger, and attachment are so powerful. In terms of comparative numbers, it's so rare to be born as a human, not to mention to be born as a human in a situation where we're able to meet the Dharma and practice the Dharma. Almost unique. So reflecting upon that and then generating renunciation of attachment to this life by thinking of death and impermanence and the sufferings of the lower realms. And then, on top of the initial scope of practicing to achieve a happy rebirth and to not go back to the lower realms from where we came, then the second level of motivation is, or of training, is to reflect upon the Four Noble Truths, in particular the extent of suffering throughout samsara, and to generate renunciation of attachment, even to happy rebirths, to aspire to achieve liberation. So that those meditations are the first point in training the mind, which is the third scope, training the mind in the intention to achieve our full potential of Buddhahood. Just nirvana, liberation, is not enough. Complete Buddhahood, because as a Buddha, we will have all of the wisdom and the accumulation of merit through which we will actually be able to work for others forever into the future. We will be able to, at the moment, if we want to help others, we're very limited because we can't even really stop our own suffering. And even if we are advanced in the path, still, others don't necessarily want to be helped. That's one of the sad situations of self-seeing and ignorance, that we think, I'm okay. Yeah, things aren't going perfectly, but I'm in charge of my life. Leave me alone. I can do it. Very sad. And even if one was a Buddha, there are so many beings who will be in that situation, not interested in being helped. However, if one is a Buddha, one will always be there. And at some stage, every sentient being is going to call out for help. And so, with the bodhicitta, we strongly intend to be the one who will answer their call. We will respond. Doesn't matter how long it takes, when even the most hard-headed individuals admit they can't make it or need help, then I'll be the one. So, to train our mind in such an attitude was the second point of the thought training. The two steps of generating bodhicitta, the first is through the seven steps of Mahayana cause and effect, and the second method was to train our mind in the meditations on equalizing and exchanging self and others. So we discussed those. The third of the third steps of the 7-point mind training is called the method of transforming suffering and happiness into our path to enlightenment. So the individual is trying to practice the Mahayana path, train the mind in bodhicitta. It's an aspiration. It is a wish which we develop, born out of love and compassion. But still, there are so many obstacles which will continually arise in our lives due to karma, internal obstacles, external obstacles. And so we need a method to transform every obstacle into the path, even to transform happiness into the path. Because although happiness is a welcome result of virtue, when things are going very well, then we're less motivated, we're less inclined to put in the hard work to train our mind in the path to enlightenment. So it's not just obstacles and suffering, but happiness itself can become an obstacle inasmuch as it makes us complacent and we waste our opportunity to train the mind. So we're going to discuss a short text written by Jigpe Tenpel Nyima, who he wrote this text in his previous incarnation, who died in 1926. I'm not sure if it's his second or third incarnation since then, but being very familiar with this short text, I felt incredible connection. And the Dodubchen Rinpoche, as his general name is called, he actually has a center in Boston. And I was in Boston several times, but unfortunately, when I was there, he wasn't there. So I missed the opportunity to meet him in person. This text is actually the root text upon which Lama Zofa Rinpoche based his commentary that has been written in a text called Transforming Problems. I think that's the basic name of it. Certainly in the library, I don't know about the bookshop. So, Tenpo Nyima, He begins, as most Dharma texts begin, by paying homage. And as this is a text on bodhicitta, great compassion, he pays homage to Avalokiteshvara, to Chinrezi. So as a short verse, in praise of Avalokiteshvara, he says, always happy at the happiness of others and deeply saddened when they suffer, one who has fully realized the qualities and understanding of great compassion and who renounces both his own happiness and suffering. That's his verse of praise to Avalokiteshvara. Then a foreword, he says, I'm going to write a partial instruction on how to use happiness and suffering as a path to enlightenment. This is indispensable for leading a spiritual life and quite the most precious teaching in the world. There are two parts, how to use suffering as the path and how to use happiness as the path. Each part is approached first through the relative or the conventional truth, and second through ultimate truth. So the first part, how to use suffering as a path to enlightenment through relative truth. So he begins, whenever you are harmed by sentient beings or anything, if you make a habit out of only feeling sorrow, then when even the smallest problem occurs, it will cause you enormous mental anguish. This is because the nature of any state of mind, either happiness or sorrow, is to gradually grow stronger by being repeated. So, if we habitually look at our life and there are certain situations, whether it be a mosquito or the person we have to work with, or and we constantly feel down, sorrow, oh, I don't like this situation, it's awful, I've got to do it. If our mind has this negative attitude about problems, small or even major problems, then if we allow our mind to continually abide in that state of aversion, dislike towards a situation, even if it's something about our body or mind or whatever it is, if we dwell upon it, then it becomes stronger and stronger. Our aversion grows. It's natural. And so whether we meet the problem or not, we're miserable. Particularly when we do meet it, we're far more miserable. Because, here's that person. I don't want to be with that person, or I don't want to be in this situation. And so the situation assumes a far greater threat to our happiness than it actually is. Similarly, if we cultivate a happy attitude, a pleasant attitude, of liking any situation, as it's true, isn't it? We all have particular things we like a lot. So the more we meet with that experience, whether it's going for a walk in the park or whatever, the happier we are. Yes, this is what I love in life. Whether it's another person or a situation, whatever it is, the more we habituate ourselves to seeing it as good, the happier we are. It's, in other words, the subjective state of mind is of great importance in whether situations in life are pleasing or displeasing. That's the point he's making. I mean, it's an obvious point. But we should think about it. That's true. Particularly when we're grumbling about a certain situation or person that we don't like, that grumbling will only make it worse. So he says, when the power of this repetitive way of thinking, you know, particularly aversion to problems, when that power increases, after a while, most of what you perceive will become the cause of actually attracting unhappiness towards you. Unhappiness will never have a chance. We're so conscious about this situation we don't like that the mere suggestion or hint that that person will come into my life, or that thing, or the rain, or the sun, whatever it is we don't like, we're miserable. We're looking out for it. We're even seeing this bad situation where it doesn't exist. And he says, when we're like that, we're so self-conscious, almost to the point of paranoia, you know, where we imagine things are harmful towards us. He says, happiness will never have a chance. This is so fundamental in life. He says, if you do not recognize that it all depends on the way in which your mind develops that habit, that aversion, that being miserable about things going wrong. And if you put the blame on external objects alone, see, if we don't recognize the subjective part played in unhappiness, and if we only blame others or external situations, then the flames of suffering and of negative karma, aggression, will spread like wildfire without end. This is what is called all appearances, right? Outer appearances, and all perceptions, subjective perceptions of things, all appearances and perceptions arise as enemies. The whole world appears hostile towards us. I know people like that, who get so caught up in anxiety and grumbling, complaining, that they can see no good in anybody or anything. And their mind is so sensitive, so unhappy. So Tenpo Nyingma says, you should thoroughly understand that the whole reason why sentient beings in this degenerate age, right, this time of, you know, the cycles of degeneration, things are getting worse, society's getting worse, the afflictions are getting worse, the times are getting worse, and so on. When we and all the sentient beings in the world today are plagued by so much suffering, that this is all to do with this weakness of their discriminating awareness. Weakness of their understanding of what's going on in their minds. Yes, there are external problems arising from karma, but how much they affect us is dependent upon our daily attitude that we cultivate. He says, therefore, not to be hurt by obstacles created by external enemies, by illness, or by harmful influences, doesn't mean to say that things like sickness and so on can be driven away and that they'll never occur again. That's not the meaning. The meaning is simply that when they do happen, they will not become obstacles in our Dharma practice, in the way we practice towards enlightenment. In fact, if we can maintain a positive attitude without always grumbling, these apparent obstacles will become aids to our progress on the path. So everybody's terrified about coronavirus. You know, oh, how terrible if it comes. Okay, do what's necessary to not get infected, but don't, from our side, see it as a major threat to my happiness. Worry, worry, concern, concern, anxiety, anxiety. All right, do what we can to avoid it, but if it comes, we'll deal with it. Okay, it's the end of my life, so what? As we've already talked about, we're all born with a karmically determined lifespan. And if coronavirus is to be the one that is to be the condition for my karmic lifespan to end, okay, keep the mind positive. If it's not, then I will recover. Most people will recover anyway. So, in order for obstacles to not shake us from our Dharma practice, in order, well, just for that purpose, for that to happen, you need to first get rid of the attitude of only wanting yourself not to suffer. And secondly, cultivate the attitude of actually being joyful when suffering occurs. So now I'll explain how to do that. So first, how to abandon the attitude of just wanting oneself not to have problems, not to suffer. So we have to consciously reject the attitude of not wanting ourselves to suffer, right? Our aversion to the pains and the problems and the things which preoccupy our mind. So he says, from your own experience, convince yourself again and again of the uselessness and the bitter pain involved in regarding suffering as something purely harmful and purely undesirable. And recognize how much nervous anxiety you go through simply from not wanting it to happen. That's true. Now, it hasn't happened yet, but we're anxious and we're nervous and we're worried. We don't want it to happen. That anxious attitude is suffering in itself, and it's not necessary. At the same time, train yourself to have great courage by reflecting again and again, from now on, whatever suffering I face, whatever problem occurs in my life, I will not become anxious. See, it's up to us. I read a story this morning about a lady in Australia who was a shop assistant in a jewellery store, and a thief came in and tried to steal a necklace, some diamond or whatnot, a valuable necklace. And like he was really threatening, he even had a weapon, and she had hold of one part of the necklace and he was trying to pull it. And she was holding on so tight and resisting this aggression from the thief. And he even so tight that even began to cut her skin of her hands. Finally, the thief let go and ran away. So she's an incredibly brave thing. She prevented the theft. But from that moment on, her life totally fell apart with anxiety. She couldn't work in that shop anymore. She couldn't even work in the shopping centre where the shop was. She couldn't sleep. She was, any slight noise gave her a fright. She was overwhelmed by anxiety. You know, on and on and on again. So, I mean, a terribly sad situation, and a common situation. What do we call it these days? Post-traumatic stress disorder. That comes from the mind. We're not saying, you idiot, it's just in your mind. We're not saying that. We're not putting people down. It's a reality. But it does just come from the mind. Yes, there was the traumatic situation that precipitated that. But so many people experience similar traumas, but they don't generate the post-traumatic stress syndrome. What's the difference? Same external trauma. Difference is their subjective mind, the way they deal with it. So, we have little post-traumatic stress syndromes all the time. That night, we had a horrible night because the mosquito was buzzing around my head all night, you know. That echoes, that remains in our mind, and suddenly mosquitoes become our biggest enemy. And we see what, even they're not buzzing around our head, we can't sleep because we've got to get rid of it. We've got to either kill it or catch it. If we're a Buddhist, we don't kill them, we catch them in a glass and we put them outside. Or if we're a real Buddhist, we let them have a little drink of blood, like Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche. Okay. So how do we not become anxious? The first point, Tenpo Nyima says, think about the uselessness of regarding suffering as purely harmful and purely undesirable. Oh, bad, I don't want that. And he quotes Shantideva. I'm sure you know the verse of Shantideva, where if you think about the problem and you think, well, look, if there's something that you can do to resolve the problem, there's no need to be unhappy about it. Unhappy is just pouring salt into the wound. But if there's nothing you can do to resolve the problem, then it doesn't help to be unhappy either. Right? Happen can't be reversed. If I could allow my mind to dwell on this thief threatening me, I don't know, with a gun or whatever, but I hang on to the necklace. So if we let our mind replay that traumatic event over and over again, we're pouring salt onto the wound. We are allowing our mind to perpetuate the situation. It's useless. Worry and anxiety are useless. So how to deal with anxiety? Recognize it and stand up to our own mind. Talk to your mind. They won't lock you up, think you're crazy. Well, they might, if we talk to ourselves. But we should treat our mind like a little child. Gently, but firmly. Mind, stop replaying that broken record of anxiety. Let it go. The problem has passed. That's history. Let it go. Be at peace. You're only hurting yourself. That's what we're saying to our mind. So, Tenpo Nyima's first point is the uselessness of dwelling in anxiety. And the second point is, just think about the tremendous pain and stress involved in being anxious and worrying about problems. He says, if you don't become anxious, then the strength of mind you have will make it simple for you to bear even the hardest suffering. That even the hardest pain or problem will feel flimsy, insubstantial, like the touch of cotton wool. But if you are dominated by anxiety, even the smallest problem becomes absolutely unbearable, as your mind is oppressed by a continuous feeling of unhappiness. I mean, there are certain children who have to go to the doctor or the nurse and receive an injection. So, some children, you can't get them out of the house to go to the surgery. They're so terrified and anxious, and the closer they get to the doctor's surgery, the more anxious they feel. And when the doctor gets out the syringe, puts the liquid in it, squirts a little bit out, it looks like a harpoon. And the child is screaming. Mother is upset, the nurses are upset, the doctor's upset, and the child is so upset. And yet, there are other children for whom the injection is nothing. Same injection, absolutely no hassle whatsoever. The difference is in the mind. So, childlike mind. Tepa Nyima gives an example, clear example. Like, if we're Buddhists and we're trying to overcome desire for a particular person, physical desire through attachment, then if we allow our mind to think about that beautiful person, how can we get rid of desire for them? We just allow our mind to dwell on them, go into a fantasy of experiencing pleasure. No way can we overcome desire. You'll just wear yourself out. So we've got to understand that our mind is something that needs to be controlled. A lot of bad habits. And the only thing which will cure the bad habits of mind is mind itself. It will cure itself. So he says, similarly, by concentrating intensely on the painful qualities of suffering, like concentrating on a beautiful person, can't get rid of desire. So if we let our mind concentrate on the undesirable qualities of suffering, you will not be able to develop any patience or endurance. So, he says, as in the instructions in the text upon how to deal with desire or anger by sealing the door of your senses, if you feel you're in a situation where anger or desire or pride or jealousy are manifesting, seal the door. Like, go out of the room. Separate yourself from the object of attachment or anger or pride or jealousy, whatever it is. And give yourself some space to not just dwell upon the situation. Go out, think about something else. So as in that way, those teachings of overcoming attachment in particular and anger, you must not focus on the suffering and get caught up in its characteristics. Don't dwell upon all the aspects of suffering. Instead, get used to bringing your mind home to where it belongs. Where does our mind belong? What is the natural state of mind? The natural state of consciousness, the stream of awareness. When there are no disturbing emotions manifesting, like when we're meditating, The mind initially is, oh, it's going here, there, and everywhere. Particularly if we allow an anxiety or an attachment to come in, the mind is not at peace. It's troubled. The whole purpose of meditation is to eliminate those disturbing emotions, and with their elimination, the natural peace and stillness shines forth. Just meditating on the breath, coming and going with the breath, is so beneficial by reducing and eliminating the disturbing thoughts. You don't create an artificial state of peace. It is the natural, blissful peace and stillness of your mind. That should be our home base. That's what he's saying. Bring your mind home to where it belongs and rest there in the natural space of peace and stillness. So simple. But do we do it? No. Nope. We allow our mind to get caught up in so much unnecessary anxiety. Okay? So that is how to abandon the attitude of not wanting suffering. Okay? Very straightforward. We can do it, we must do it. Seeking the happiness of this life is not a Dhamma motivation. It's negative. Just focusing on happiness in this life. However, to experience happiness has advantages from the point of view of practicing Dhamma. If we're miserable, we can't practice Dharma. And anyway, being happy in this life is much better than suffering. Now, happiness, yeah, we know from the Lumrim, mundane happiness is a type of suffering, the suffering of change. But still, it's better than the suffering of pain. Okay. But to generate a real Dharma, the first level of Dharma motivation, to be happy in the future lives, then this is the method. Okay, so now his second point in transforming problems into the path is to cultivate, we have to cultivate the attitude of being joyful when suffering occurs, arises. So he explains, he says, look, practice cultivating a sense of joy by seeing suffering as an aid to the path to enlightenment. This is an opportunity. Whenever suffering arises, no, whatever problems arise, if you do not have a virtuous practice to apply to them, and one that fits your ability of your mind, then it will be very difficult to succeed. All right? There's a, maybe, I don't know, even outside the door, but even inside here, there's a whole queue of problems waiting to get us. Right. And they're coming. And no matter what we do, in terms of having inoculations, wearing face masks, the problems are out there and they're going to catch us. So we must be familiar with a virtuous practice to immediately put into effect when the unwelcome problem occurs, as it will, as they will, one after another. That's reality. And also, the practice, we have to be capable of doing it, which means we have to have trained our mind in advance to deal with the potential problems that will come in our life. Then it will be easy. It's unexpected. A sudden diagnosis. Small illness, big illness, cancer, dying. We're all going to get those diagnoses. They're waiting to happen. When I studied pathology, I remember the professor of pathology saying, if you live long enough, you'll die of cancer. No. Why is it happening? If something doesn't get us before that, the cancer will. And I remember in the pathology museum at the university, you know, they have all these diseased organs in pots of formalin for the medical students to look at and study. And I remember sitting in the middle of that pathology museum thinking, how did I ever get to be an adult without getting one of these diseases? There are so many diseases that can happen. So, here is a warning he gives us now. He says, you may spend a lot of time contemplating the general notion that to have a certain skillful means and to use suffering as the path can bring benefit. But just having the general knowledge that suffering can be transformed into the path is not enough. We've got to be able to do it. He says, just having the general idea, then the result of transforming suffering into the path will be as further apart from than the earth is from the sky. Therefore, use suffering as the basis for the following practices. So now he gives a list of practices which we can think about and choose which one fits our mind, which one appeals to us, which one we can train our mind to put into effect. The first is the practice of using suffering to train our mind in renunciation. Right? Renunciation of attachment to the happiness of mundane existence. So he says, acknowledge that for as long as you wander in samsara, powerless and without any independence, the suffering that arises is not something unjust or unfair, but it's the very nature of samsara. So I've actually used this sentence to concoct a title for the book that I wrote about my travels and discovering Buddhism and becoming a monk and so on. So the title I used was A Leaf in the Wind. So you imagine a dried leaf, it has no choice. Wherever the wind blows, leaf has no choice but to be pushed by the wind in this direction or that direction. It has no independent power to stop being pushed by the wind. That is ourselves in samsara. We are pushed by the winds of karma and disturbing emotions. So karma, in essence, refers to desire, craving sensory pleasure, craving mental pleasure. And then the actions following upon craving for pleasure and craving to be apart from pain, then that creates karma. So that is the wind. That is samsara. That is samsara. The individual, like a leaf in the wind, totally out of control, no independence, being pushed into this situation and that. So, when the problem arises, of course it arises. This is the nature of samsara. Also, so knowing that, we don't collapse in a heap of self-pity. Oh, poor me. No, it's not fair. I had so many things I wanted to do and achieve. It's just, you know, cries, tears, wallowing in pity. Hey, it happens. So mind, stop. Your belly aching. He says, then his next bit of advice in training our mind in renunciation. Also, if it is so very difficult to bear even the little suffering and pain of the happy role of a human being, then no point in mentioning being able to bear the suffering of the lower realms. Animals, hungry ghosts, hell beings. So when we experience the relatively minor problems of humans, he says, let a deep sense of sadness and disillusionment arise by thinking, alas, samsara is an endless and bottomless ocean of suffering, and turn your mind towards liberation, to nirvana and enlightenment. The Tibetan word that we translate into English, alas, is kiemo. I guess there must be a Chinese word for calling out in despair or alas. I don't know what it is. But every culture has their term. Do you have a term? What is it? All right. So, instead of falling apart, yes, this is the nature of samsara, and generate renunciation is the lotus upon which a Buddha sits. And upon the lotus, there's the moon disc of bodhicitta, which means you cannot have bodhicitta if you don't have renunciation. And on the moon disc of bodhicitta, there's the sun disc, the golden disc of wisdom, realizing ultimate reality. You cannot have the wisdom realizing ultimate reality without the lotus of renunciation. Renunciation is an incredibly great realization. Also, you cannot have renunciation if you don't have single point of concentration, calm abiding. Shamatha. You can't have calm abiding if you don't observe pure morality of non-harmfulness. So, you see, this problem has alerted me to the whole path. The three higher trainings, morality, wisdom, concentration. The three fundamental aspects of the path. Renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom realizing emptiness. This problem has reminded me. I mean, regarding renunciation, I when I was first ordained, I had no idea what renunciation meant. And there was one time, I think I'd been a monk just a few months, and I was at Tishita, a retreat center in Dharamsala in India. And Lama Yeshe, my teacher, was there. And he was talking to some American guy who I'd never met before, who was a student of Lama's from before. And as I walked past, Lama Yeshe told me to come over, and he introduced me to this guy. And I had just finished a retreat. It was a retreat on Mahakala, a 4-week retreat. No, it was a Vajrasattva retreat, 3-month retreat. And during that 3 months of the monsoon time at Tishita, when it wasn't raining, I would eat my lunch on a wall looking down upon the lower garden. So that wall was my perimeter. I couldn't go beyond. And so, you know, before meeting Buddhism, I was what they called a hippie, investigating various substances and things in life, you know, purely educational reasons. A sense, a degree of truth in that. Anyway, in that garden, India, the Indian hemp, the marijuana plants just grow naturally. And for the 3 months, I watched these plants grow from that big to over 2 meters high. And I just observed them. And that morning, before I met Lama Yeshe, I'd finished the retreat. And so I went down to McLeod Ganj, the small village on the ridge, for the first time after 3 months. And as I walked past those plants, I just put my hand out to pat them for old time's sake. Yeah. And my hand turned to fire, because I didn't see it. But amongst those marijuana plants was one big stinging nettle, and I touched the stinging nettle. Thought, wow, there's a lesson. Anyway, I met a German monk and we had lemonade together and had a good time. So when I came back to Tishir, that's when I came across Lama Yeshe. And he called me over to this American guy and introduced me. He said, "This is Dr. Adrian." He used to call me Dr. Adrian. "He's just become a monk. He's achieved the renounced mind of samsara." And I thought about it. Renunciation. And I didn't even really know what renunciation of samsara was. But I said to Lama, "No, Lama, not yet." And he got all serious. He grabbed me by the shoulder. "Not yet. Good answer. You won't get renunciation for a long time. Renunciation is big. Realization." So, that was the way the Lama teaches. So, every problem is an opportunity to train our mind in renunciation and to stop being a leaf in the wind, being blown helplessly by karma and disturbing emotions. So, as Tenpo Nyima says, do so by calling, "Alas, samsara is an endless and bottomless ocean of suffering," and turn your mind towards liberation, renunciation. So that's the first method. Second is to use problems and suffering to train our mind in refuge. Refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, also is an incredibly profound realization. Don't think that you have achieved refuge at the refuge ceremony and you've been given a Dharma name. "Oh yes, I'm a Buddhist." Refuge is a state of mind which grows continuously on the whole path up to enlightenment. You know that initial refuge is related to the external Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. But as you advance on the path, your refuge becomes the internal Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Your mind becomes Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And so that is the inner refuge. And that is something which grows stronger right up to the 10th Bodhisattva ground. So, problems are very useful for training our mind in refuge. So Tenpo Nyima's advice is, when problems happen, think, "Throughout all my lives, one after the other, the only unfailing source of refuge from this continuous pain and fear is the three jewels. So I must rely upon them to totally. And whatever happens, I will never renounce them. He says, make this into a firm conviction and then do the practice of taking refuge, right? So when problems happen, you visualize Buddha and you recite Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, or whichever language you like, Sanskrit or Tibetan or Chinese or English, you recite the refuge form from your heart. And it was we're supposed to do that anyway, at least three times each morning, three times at night, but that's at least. It's good to bring refuge in the three jewels. Constant. That's the whole point of having holy images and Amitabha above the entrance. People, and it's great. Here, I see people stop in the street and they take refuge. Absolutely fantastic. So wonderful. The inspiration of the Guru to make this offering to the people who live in this area. Thirdly, we can use problems to train our mind in patience. Patience is the antidote to anger. Anger is our worst enemy. You know, we dwell upon physical problems or health problems or external problems as being really bad. But our anger is far worse, far, far worse than any external problem that could happen in life. Patience is that virtuous ability to remain calm and peaceful in the face of adversity. You know that in the love room there's advice at this point that when somebody is annoying you, doing things which upset you deliberately or even not deliberately, and there are a lot of things which people do completely unintending, not intending to upset us, but because of our way of how I want things to be done, we get upset. We get annoyed at their habits, which is just natural for them, but we get angry. So, if we realize, as Shantideva says, patience, which is the antidote to anger, can only be developed in the face of adversity, only when we're getting upset. You know, unhappiness, right, that is the precursor of anger. Unhappiness is not anger. Anger is, you know, an aggressive attitude wanting to hurt, push away the object of discomfort. And that comes from an unhappy mind. If the mind is happy, anger can't manifest. The mind first has to become unhappy. So if we see the person upsetting us, if we think, look, mind, you need this person to upset you because then you can practice patience. This person is in fact your guru, your teacher, giving you the opportunity to patiently stay calm and not get angry. All right. Love is the opposite of anger. Right? Patience is the antidote. Love is the opposite. We know the benefits of having genuine love and affection for others. If we can't have patience, how can we have love? Impossible. Okay, next. Using suffering to remove arrogance and pride. Another root affliction, a root problem. This haughtiness, this putting others down, seeing self as superior in one way or another. So Tenpo Nyima, he says, annihilate pride and contempt for others, which are the destructive enemies of merits, by seeing how in samsara you have no freedom or independence from being controlled by suffering. You see, pride is, I'm good, I'm special, I can deal with that situation. I'm better than others. But when problems happen, we're not. Our pretense of being a cool, calm, capable person is blown away. And that pretense is arrogance. So we tell ourselves, you're not as clever as you think you are. Look, this problem has arisen in your life. So we should reflect, in overcoming arrogance, the antidote is rejoicing in the good qualities of others. Seeing that others even have qualities better than me, and how fantastic, how great that they're wealthy, that they're enjoying this, that they have happiness and health. Sincerely rejoicing in it. Lama Sofa Rinpoche, in his commentary to this point, he said that the inability to rejoice in the good things of others can drive people crazy. It motivates crazy actions, and one cannot be happy. So problems give us the chance to get rid of our pride, our arrogance, our dislike of good things happening to others. These are definitely childish characteristics, sibling rivalry and children fighting in the schoolyard. But we carry or we take those childlike attitudes into our adult life, and we might cover them up a bit or pretend, but if we're really honest, we adults look at our disturbed mind. Our mind is acting like a child in the playground at school. Okay, another one: use suffering to purify harmful and negative actions. So we know from the teachings on karma, if you were here on the weekend, that every suffering we experience, every problem, is a result of negative karma. And even not only minor sufferings, but the greatest sufferings have an underlying karmic cause. They come from our own harmful negative actions towards others. So reflect when problems occur, think deeply about karmic cause and effect, and think, really, if I don't want problems, I have to purify my karma. So use sickness or whatever the problem is to strongly put into practice the four opponent powers to purify your negative karma. Do those prostrations, the 35 Buddhas. Even we're not aware of the specific cause that we created for this problem. Still, when we do prostration of the 35 Buddhas or Vajrasattva mantra, whatever action we're doing within the four opponent powers, then we will purify that cause as well as all other causes. When we think, whatever we've done, if we visualize the purifying nectar and so on, this works. And the stronger it works is dependent, or the strength of its working is dependent upon the degree of regret and sincere remorse we have in doing that action. So remorse is the first opponent power. So what gives very strong regret and remorse is suffering. And, well, it also gives the chance to train our mind in compassion. Because not only am I experiencing this problem, but so many others are experiencing the same type of problem, and even heavier problems than myself. So we should train our mind in compassion. Tenpo Nyima says, reflect on how, just like yourself, all other sentient beings are oppressed with the same or even greater suffering, and train yourself in thinking how good it would be if they too were to be free from all this suffering. He says, this will bring an understanding of how to practice loving kindness, the aspiration to help those who have no happiness. By my experiencing this problem, I really know what they're experiencing, what they're feeling. So not only do we purify negative karma, but we train our mind in compassion. And also, when problems occur, we can use this problem to become more convinced in the value of virtue. We can gain great joy in doing virtuous karmic actions. He says, reflect that if you truly want happiness, which is the opposite of suffering, then you should try to practice the cause of happiness, virtue. Consider thoroughly and at length how to increase your virtuous actions. Right? So many methods. Problem happening, stop whinging and think how I can do greater virtue, I must do more virtue. How wonderful it would be to do virtuous acts. And the suffering has stopped because it was mostly produced by our anxiety and our preoccupation with poor me, self-pity, etc., etc. These are very skillful, down-to-earth methods to deal with everyday life problems, which we tend not to think about. We tend, ask the Lama to do some prayers for me, send some money to Copan and get the monks to recite the Heart Sutra for me. You know, all of these things. The best medicine. We have the potential to practice that medicine. We don't need to rely upon Copan. I'm not saying that it won't benefit. You know, you send your money to Copan and get the Lamas to pray for you. Sure. But they won't need to do it if we put one of these methods into practice. And the next point is actually from Rinpoche's commentary. It's not from Tenpo Nyima. Use suffering to train your mind in guru devotion. You know, this strong relationship that we must develop between ourself and our Dharma teacher. Rinpoche said, when a problem happens, think this problem is the blessing of the Guru, my Lama, purifying me by finishing my negative karmas and training my mind in Mahayana thought transformation in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. My Lama is giving me this opportunity to train my mind. And so the final one by Tenpo Nyima is suffering can be used in our meditation on seeing others as more dear than oneself. Right? We learnt the last talk in this series, self-centeredness, self-cherishing, seeing self is more important than others, is our root problem, and the solution to that is seeing others as more important than oneself. So Tenpo Nyima, he says, since the very reason why you are not free from suffering is that you have cherished yourself as most important since time without beginning, now you should practice thinking, I will only cherish others, for this is the source of all happiness and well-being. So those are the methods that Tenpo Nyima offers us. So we should become familiar with these methods. And whichever ones really fit our mind, become familiar with them. That they are should be in your pocket or somewhere to immediately bring out when the unwanted but inevitable problems arise in our life. Tenpo Nyima, he says, it's extremely difficult to use suffering as a path when it's staring you right in the face, you know, when it's happening. That is why it's essential to become familiar beforehand with these practices to be applied in problematic situations. And also why it is particularly useful to apply a practice which is most meaningful for you and of which you have a clear personal experience. Simply for suffering to become of help to your practice is not enough. You must be sure to develop the strong, stable, and continuous sense of joy that comes from recognizing what has happened, right? So this is something extra. We apply one of these antidotes to suffering, and then we, yes, it worked. It was true. And that joy will give the courage and the determination to continue the practice. He says, whenever you practice what I've explained here, realize that this very suffering you experience is giving you tremendous help towards attaining the great lasting peace and happiness of the higher realms, of liberation and enlightenment, which are so difficult to reach, and that it will go on and on being like this. Yeah, so this is my method. Yes, I have the method to deal with life, all the problems of life. That, how unbelievably fortunate. He says, then, even if your suffering is very intense, it will turn out to be an utterly joyful thing. He says, like a sweet made of sugar mixed with cardamom and peppers. So I think from that metaphor, the sugar and the cardamom are sweet, but the peppers are a little bit, there is suffering happening. But the sugar and the cardamom dominate. The sweetness dominates. It says, go over this in your mind very thoroughly, again and again, and make this feeling of inner peace and happiness a habit. Now we have a habit of anxiety, a habit of depression, and self-pity. That's just a habit. Replace that habit with this feeling of inner peace and happiness. Our home base, right? When you've done this, the overflowing abundance of happiness within your mind will make the suffering of the senses seem as imperceptible. The ability of the mental consciousness, the mind, not to be upset or harmed at all by physical suffering is in fact the criterion for overcoming illness through patience. you should appreciate that the same principle applies for overcoming things like enemies and harmful spirits. As I explained before, reversing the attitude of not wanting suffering is the foundation for making suffering become the path. This is because for as long as you lose heart and your mind is disturbed as a result of nervous anxiety, you simply cannot turn suffering into the path. By training in actually making suffering your path, you will also discover a new strength in your ability to be happy. Since, as a result of your experience in developing your practice through suffering, you will become more and more cheerful. I mean, why do we want to be more and more cheerful? Because we're surrounded by people who depend upon us for their happiness. If we're self-centered and miserable and worried about me, that echoes and affects the members of our family, the people we meet, our circle of friends, everybody in society. We are miserable. We make them miserable. It's said, according to Tenpo Nyima, that if you gradually train yourself with small problems and sufferings in easy, gradual stages, then in the end, you'll be able to handle even the big ones too. This should be your approach, because it's extremely difficult to have a valid experience of something which is beyond the scope of your own mind. So if we haven't trained dealing with small problems, we won't have the capacity to deal with the big problems which are coming. He says, in between meditation sessions, pray to the Lama and the Three Jewels to be able to make suffering become the path. And when your mind is a little bit stronger, make offerings to the Three Jewels and to harmful spirits, and insist that they put you in troublesome situations. Like, you know, we make offerings to the Buddhas, protect me, look after me. But now we make offerings, please send me more problems. You know, we're training our mind in bodhicitta, right? We do tonglen, we pray for the problems of others to ripen upon us. When a problem occurs, this is what I prayed for. I'm taking the suffering of others upon myself. My prayers have been answered. So we pray for the troublesome situations so that we can work on developing the strength of our practice. He said, here, through this, you should always have a deep, confident joy and cheerfulness. When you first begin this training, it's vital, when you practice, to keep apart from busyness and distractions. In the midst of busyness, you can get influenced by all kinds of misdirected friends who will ask you, how can you possibly put up with such suffering and humiliation? Worrying a lot about enemies, relatives, and possessions will cloud your awareness and disturb your mind beyond your control, so that you'll slip into bad habits. Then on top of that, you'll become lost in all kinds of distracting objects and situations. In the solitude of a retreat environment where none of these things exist, your awareness will be very clear, and as a result, it will be easy to settle the mind and concentrate. Obvious advice. We have to do it. It says, to sum up, not only so that your mind will not be affected by any problematic situations or suffering, but also to be able to draw happiness and peace of mind out of these things themselves, should put a stop to the attitude of not wanting things like illness inside or enemies, spirits, disruptive talk outside, and instead get used simply to the feeling of being pleased and delighted at whatever happens. To do this, you need to stop regarding dangerous and threatening situations as something wrong and put all your energy into training yourself to see them as fruitful, valuable, and positive. So, whether something is pleasing or not depends entirely on how the mind grasps onto it. For example, if someone consistently dwells on the shortcomings of worldly distractions and enjoyment, no matter how much their wealth or the number of people around them increase, they will only become that much more sick and tired of them all. On the other hand, someone who sees all worldly enjoyments as beneficial, important, then no matter what they have, they will always aspire to increasing their prosperity, increasing their social standing, increasing their circle of friends. You know, they're not satisfied. He says, but with this training, your mind and your character will become gentle and flexible. It will become broader and more open. You will become more easy to be with, courageous and confident. You'll have no obstacles to practice. All negative circumstances will arise as splendid and auspicious. And your mind will always be content in the happiness born of peace. To practice the path to enlightenment in this degenerate age, you cannot be without armor of this type. When you are not at the mercy of the suffering caused by anxiety, then not only will all the other kinds of suffering evaporate, like weapons dropping from the hands of soldiers, but even illnesses which will normally disappear on their own. The holy ones of the past used to have some sayings which can give us some understanding, like, the problems will go away. And this is a saying he quotes, when you are not unhappy or discontent about anything, your mind is not disturbed. When your mind is not disturbed, the wind energies which support mind will not be disturbed. And so the other elements of the body will not be disturbed either. Because of this, your mind will remain undisturbed. And so the wheel of constant happiness will turn. Okay, so just a few more paragraphs on this section of transforming suffering into the path by first seeing the uselessness of anxiety and secondly seeing the benefit of problems. Next time we'll complete this section and then we'll discuss how to transform happiness into the path as well, so that happiness does not become an obstacle. So, as I mentioned, Lama Zopa Rinpoche has made a commentary on this text. This root text is in the back of the book called Transforming Problems. It's in our bookshop here, but probably. If not, find it. Find a copy on Google and buy it. Or maybe Sui Kim will print a copy of it. Okay, so personally, I find great joy and delight in this text by Lama Tsenpo Nyima. I don't put it into practice as often as I should, but whenever I read it and talk about it in a group like this, I'm always re-inspired to incorporate this down-to-earth, common sense, clear explanation of how to practice Dharma and how to deal with problems. So I hope that you also feel inspired and will be able to use it in every situation which presents an obstacle to your peace of mind and your Dharma practice. So let's collectively then dedicate all the positive energy of discussing bodhicitta, how rare it is to discuss bodhicitta, how unbelievable rare, to discuss teachings like this. Such benefit for ourselves and others. Through this positive energy, think, may I practice the path of bodhisattva, achieve my potential of enlightenment, and be always there when mother sentient beings cry out for help. As a Buddha, I will be the one to answer their call. Thank you so much.